5. "So," said Don Lorenzo Salvara, "you wish me to continue deliberately granting promissory notes to a man that you describe as the most capable thief in Camorra?" "Respectfully, my lord Salvara, that's what you would have done anyway, even without our intervention." When Locke spoke, there was no hint of Lucas Fairwhite in his voice or in his mannerisms. There was no trace of the Vadran merchant's restrained energy or stuffy dignity. This new fiction had the fictional backing of the Duke's incontrovertible writ. He was the sort of man who could and would tease a don while invading the sanctity of that don's home. Such audacity could never be faked. Locke had to feel it, summon it from somewhere inside, cloak himself in arrogance as though it were an old familiar garment. Locke Lamora became a shadow in his own mind. He was a midnighter, an officer in the Duke's silent constabulary. Locke's complicated lies were this new man's simple truth. "The sums discussed could easily total half my available holdings." "Then give our friend Fairwhite half your fortune, my lord. Choke the thorn on exactly what he desires. Promissory notes will tie him down, keep him moving back and forth between counting houses."
"Counting houses that will throw my very real money after this phantom, you mean?"
"Yes, in the service of the Duke, no less. Take heart, my lord Salvara. His grace is entirely capable of compensating you for any loss you incur while aiding us in the capture of this man. In my opinion, though, the thorn will have time to neither spend it nor move it very far. So your stolen money should be recovered before that even becomes necessary. You must also consider the aspects of the situation that are not strictly financial."
"Meaning?"
"His grace's gratitude for your assistance in bringing this matter to our desired outcome," said Locke, "balanced against his certain displeasure if any reluctance on your part should alert our thief to the net drawing tight around him."
"Ah." Don Salvara picked his optics up and resettled them on his nose. "With that, I can hardly argue."
"I will not be able to speak to you in public. No uniformed member of the Camorra Watch will approach you for any reason related to this affair. If I speak to you at all, it must be at night, in secret."
"Am I to tell Conte to keep refreshments at hand for men coming in through the windows? Shall I tell the Doña Sofia to send any midnighters to my study if they should pop out of her wardrobe closet?"
"I give you my word, any future appearances will be less alarming, my lord. My instructions were to impress upon you the seriousness of the situation and the full extent of our ability to bypass obstacles. I assure you, I have no personal desire to antagonize you any further. Resecuring your fortune will be the capstone to many months of hard work on my part."
"And the Doña Sofia? Has your master dictated a part for her in this counter-charade?"
"Your wife is a most extraordinary woman. By all means, inform her of our involvement. Tell her the truth about Lucas Fairwhite. Enlist her very capable aid in our endeavor. However," Locke said, grinning malignantly, "I do believe that I shall regretfully leave you the task of explaining this to her on your own, my lord."
6. On the landward side of Camorra, armed men paced the old stone walls of the city, ever vigilant for signs of bandits or hostile armies in the field. On the seaward side, watchtowers and war galleys served the same purpose. At the guard stations on the periphery of the Alcigrante district, the city watch stands ready to protect the city's lesser nobility from the annoyance of having to see or smell any of their actual subjects against their wishes. Locke and Carlo crossed the Angevine just before midnight on the broad glass bridge called the Eldrin Arch. This ornately carved span connected the western Alcigrante with the lush semi-public gardens of Two Silver Green, another spot where the insufficiently well-heeled were discouraged from lingering, often with whips and batons. Tall cylinders of ruby-coloured glass shed alchemical light onto the wispy threads of mist that curled and wavered below the knees of their horses. The centre of the bridge was 50 feet above the water, and the usual night fog reached no higher. The red lamps swayed gently within their black iron frames as the muggy hangman's breeze spun them, and the two gentlemen bastards rode down into the Alchigrante with that eerie light surrounding them like a bloody aura.
"Hold there! State your name and business!"
At the point where the bridge met the Angevin's north shore, there was a low wooden shack with oil-paper windows, through which a pale white glow emanated. A single figure stood beside it, his yellow tabard turned to orange in the light of the bridge lamps. The speaker's words might have been bold, but his voice was young and a little uncertain. Locke smiled. The Alchigrante guard shacks always held two yellow jackets, but at this one the more senior had clearly sent his less hardened partner out into the fog to do the actual work. So much the better. Locke pulled his precious sigil wallet out of his black cloak as his horse cantered down beside the guard station.
"My name is Immaterial."
Locke flipped the wallet open to allow the round-faced young city watchman a glimpse of the sigil by the light of his guard station.
"My business is that of His Grace, Duke Nicovante."
I see, sir."
"I never came this way. We did not speak. Be sure that your fellow watchman understands this as well."
The yellow jacket bowed and took a quick step backward, as though afraid to stay too close. Locke smiled. Black-cloaked riders on black horses looming out of darkness and mist. It was easy to laugh at such conceits in full daylight, but night had a way of lending weight to phantasms. If Coinkisser's Row was where Camor's money was put to use, the Alchigrante district was where it was put to rest. It was four connected islands, each a sort of tiered hill sloping up to the base of the plateau that held the five towers. Old money and new money mingled crazy quilt fashion here in mazes of manor houses and private gardens. Here the merchants and money changers and shipbrokers looked down comfortably on the rest of the city. Here the lesser nobility looked up covetously at the towers of the five families who ruled all. Carriages clattered past from time to time, their black lacquered wooden cabins trailing bobbing lanterns and banners, proclaiming the arms of whoever travelled within. Some of these were guarded by teams of armed outriders in slashed doublets and polished breastplates, this year's fashion for rented thugs. A few teams of horses wore harnesses spotted with miniature alchemical lights. These appeared at a distance, looking like chains of fireflies bobbing in the mist. Don Salvara's manor was a four-story pillared rectangle, several centuries old and sagging a bit under the weight of its years, for it had been built entirely by human hands. It was a sort of island unto itself at the heart of the Isla Durona, westernmost neighborhood of the Alchigrante, surrounded on all sides by a 12-foot stone wall and enclosed by thick gardens. It shared no party walls with neighboring manors. Amber lights burned behind the barred windows on the third floor. Locke and Carlo quietly dismounted in the alley adjacent to the manor's northern wall. Several long nights of careful reconnaissance by Locke and Bug had revealed the easiest routes over the alley wall and up the side of the Salvara manor. Dressed as they were, hidden by mist and darkness, they would be effectively invisible as soon as they could hop the outer wall and get off the street. A moment of fortunate stillness fell upon them as Carlo tied the horses to a weathered wooden post beside the garden wall. Not a soul was in sight. Carlo stroked his horse's thin mane.
"Hoist a glass or two in memory of us if we don't come back, love."
Locke put his back against the base of the wall and cupped his hands. Carlo set a foot in this makeshift stirrup and leapt upward, propelled by the mingled strength of his legs and Locke's arms. When he'd hoisted himself quietly and carefully atop the wall, he reached back down with both arms to hoist Locke up. The Sansa twin was as wiry as Locke was slender, and the operation went smoothly. In seconds, they were both down in the wet, fragrant darkness of the garden, crouched motionless, listening. The doors on the ground floor were all protected from within by intricate clockwork fail-safes and steel bars. They simply could not be picked. But the rooftop, well, those who weren't yet important enough to live with the constant threat of assassination, often placed an inordinate degree of faith in high walls. The two thieves went up the north face of the manor house, slowly and carefully, wedging hands and feet firmly into chinks in the warm, slick stone. The first and second floors were dark and quiet. The light on the third floor was on the opposite side of the building. Hearts hammering with excitement, they hauled themselves up until they were just beneath the parapet of the roof, where they paused for a long interval, straining to catch at any sound from within the manor that would hint at discovery. The moons were stuffed away behind gauzy grey clouds. On their left, the city was an arc of blurred jewel lights shining through mist, and above them the impossible heights of the five towers stood like black shadows before the sky. The threads of light that burned on their parapets and in their windows enhanced rather than reduced their aura of menace. Staring up at them from near the ground was a sure recipe for vertigo. Locke was the first over the parapet. Peering intently by the faint light falling from above, he planted his feet on a white-tiled pathway in the center of the roof and kept them there. He was surrounded on either side by the dark shapes of bushes, blossoms, small trees, and vines. The roof was rich with the scent of vegetation and night soil. The street-level garden was a mundane affair, if well tended. This was the Doña Sofia's private botanical preserve. Most alchemical botanists, in Locke's experience, were enthusiasts of bizarre poisons. He made sure his hood and cloak were cinched tight around him and pulled his black neckcloth up over his lower face. Soft stepping along the white path, Locke and Carlo threaded their way through Sophia's garden, more carefully than if they had been walking between streams of lamp oil with their cloaks on fire. At the garden's center was a roof hatch with a simple tumbler lock. Carlo listened carefully at this door for 2 minutes with his favorite picks poised in his hands. Charming the lock took less than 10 seconds. The fourth floor. Doña Sofia's workshop. A place where the two intruders wanted even less to stumble or linger than they had in her garden. Quiet as guilty husbands coming home from a late night of drinking, they stole through the dark rooms of laboratory apparatus and potted plants, scampering for the narrow stone stairs that led downward to a side passage on the third floor. The operations of the Salvara household were well known to the gentleman bastards. The Don and Doña kept their private chambers on the third floor, across the hall from the Don's study. The second floor was the Sola, a reception and dining hall that went mostly disused when the couple had no friends over to entertain. The first floor held the kitchen, several parlors, and the servants' quarters. In addition to Conte, the Salvaras kept a pair of middle-aged housekeepers, a cook, and a young boy who served as a messenger and scullion. All of them would be asleep on the first floor. None of them posed even a fraction of a threat that Conte did. This was the part of the scheme that couldn't be planned with any precision. They had to locate the old soldier and deal with him before they could have their intended conversation with Don Salvara. Footsteps echoed from somewhere else on the floor. Locke, in the lead, crouched low and peeked around the left-hand corner. It turned out he was looking down the long passage that divided the third floor in half lengthwise. Don Salvara had left the door to his study open and was vanishing into the bedchamber. That door he closed firmly behind him, and a moment later the sound of a metal lock echoed down the hall.
"Serendipity," whispered Locke. "I suspect he'll be busy for quite some time in there. Light's still on in his study, so we know he's coming back out. Let's get the hard part over with."
Locke and Carlo slipped down the hallway, sweating now, but barely letting their heavy cloaks flutter as they moved. The long passage was tastefully decorated with hanging tapestries and shallow wall sconces in which tiny glow glasses shed no more light than that of smouldering coals. Behind the heavy doors to the Salvara's chambers, someone laughed. The stairwell at the far end of the passage was wide and circular. Steps of white marble inset with mosaic tile maps of Camor spiraled down into the solar. Here Carlo grabbed Locke by one sleeve, put a finger to his lips, and jerked his head downward.
"Listen,"
he murmured. Clang, clang. Footsteps. Clang, clang. The sequence of noises was repeated several times, growing slightly louder each time. Locke grinned at Carlo. Someone was pacing the solar, methodically checking the locks and the iron bars guarding each window. At this time of the night, there was only one man in the house who'd be doing such a thing. Carlo knelt beside the balustrade, just to the left of the top of the staircase. Anyone coming up the spiral stairs would have to pass directly beneath this position. He reached inside his cloak and took out a folded leather sack and a length of narrow-gauge rope woven from black silk. He then began to thread the silk line through and around the sack in some arcane fashion that Locke couldn't follow. Locke knelt just behind Carlo and kept one eye on the long passage they'd come down. A reappearance of the dawn was hardly likely yet, but the benefactor was said to make colorful examples of incautious thieves. Conte's light, steady footsteps echoed on the staircase beneath them. In a fair fight, the Don's man would almost certainly paint the walls with Locke and Carlo's blood, so it stood to reason that this fight would have to be as unfair as possible. At the moment the top of Conte's bald head appeared beneath him, Carlo reached out between the balustrade posts and let his crimper's hood drop. A crimper's hood, for those who've never had the occasion to be kidnapped and sold into slavery in one of the cities on the Iron Sea, looks a bit like a tent as it flutters quickly downward, borne by weights sewn into its bottom edges. Air pushes its flaps outward just before it drops down around its target's head and settles on his shoulders. Conte gave a startled jerk as Carlo yanked the black silk cord, instantly cinching the hood closed around his neck. Anyone with any real presence of mind could probably reach up and fumble such a hood loose in a matter of seconds, which is why the interior is inevitably painted with large amounts of some sweet-scented fuming narcotic purchased from a black apothecary. Knowing the nature of the man they were attempting to subdue, Locke and Carlo had spent nearly 30 crowns on the stuff Conte was breathing just now, and Locke fervently wished him much joy of it. One panic breath inside the airtight hood, that would be enough to drop any ordinary person in his or her tracks. But as Locke flew down the stairs to catch Conte's body, he saw that the man was still somehow upright, clawing at the hood, disoriented and weakened, most definitely, but still awake. A quick rap on the solar plexus, that would open his mouth and speed the drug on its way. Locke stepped in to deliver the blow, wrapping one hand around Conte's neck just beneath the crimper's hood. This nearly blew the entire game. Conte's arms flashed up and broke Locke's lackadaisical chokehold before it even began. The man's left arm snaked out to entangle Locke's right, and then Conte punched him. Once, twice, three times. Vicious jabs in his own stomach and solar plexus. With his guts an exploding constellation of pain, Locke sank down against his would-be victim, struggling for balance. Conte brought his right knee up in a blow that should have knocked Locke's teeth out of his ears at high speed, but the drug was finally, thankfully, smothering the old soldier's will to be ornery. The knee barely grazed Locke's chin. Instead, the booted foot attached to it caught him in the groin and knocked him backward. His head bounced against the hard marble of the stairs, somewhat cushioned by the cloth of his hood. Locke lay there, gasping for breath, still hanging awkwardly by one of the hooded man's arms. Carlo appeared at that instant, having dropped the line that cinched his crimper's hood and dashed down the stairs. He slipped one foot behind Conte's increasingly wobbly legs and pushed the man down the stairs, holding him by the front of his doublet to keep the fall relatively quiet. Once Conte was head down and prone, Carlo punched him rather mercilessly between the legs. Once, then again when the man's legs twitched feebly, and then again, which yielded no response. The hood had finally done its work. With Conte temporarily disposed of, Carlo turned to Locke and tried to help him to a sitting position, but Locke waved him off.
"What sort of state are you in?"
Carlo whispered.
"As though I'm with child and the little bastard is trying to cut his way out with an axe."
Chest heaving, Locke tore his black mask down off his face, lest he vomit inside it and create an unconcealable mess. While Locke gulped deep breaths and tried to control his shuddering, Carlo crouched back down beside Conte and tore the hood off, briskly waving away the sickly sweet aroma of the leather bag's contents. He carefully folded the hood up, slipped it into his cloak, and then dragged Conte up a few steps.
"Carlo!"
Locke coughed.
"My disguise! Damaged? Not that I can see. Looks like he didn't do anything that shows, provided you can walk without a slouch. Stay here a moment."
Carlo slipped down to the foot of the stairs and took a peek around the darkened solar. Soft city light fell through the barred windows, faintly illuminating a long table and a number of glass cases on the walls, holding plates and unidentifiable knick-knacks. Not another soul was in sight, and not a sound could be heard from below. When Carlo returned, Locke had pushed himself up on his knees and hands. Conte slumbered beside him with a look of comical bliss on his craggy face.
"Oh, he's not going to keep that expression when he wakes up."
Carlo waved a pair of thin, leather-padded brass knuckles at Locke, then made them vanish up his sleeves with a graceful flourish.
"I had my footpad's little friends on when I knocked him around that last time. Well, I for one have no expressions of sympathy to spare since he kicked my balls hard enough to make them permanent residents of my lungs."
Locke tried to push himself up off his hands and failed. Carlo caught him under his right arm and eased him up until he was kneeling shakily on his knees alone.
"You've got your breath back at least. Can you actually walk?" "I can stumble, I think. I'll be hunched over for a while. Give me a few minutes, and I think I can pretend nothing's wrong, at least until we're out of here."
Carlo assisted Locke back up the stairs to the third floor. Leaving Locke there to keep watch, he then began to quietly, slowly drag Conte up the same way. The Don's man didn't actually weigh all that much. Embarrassed and eager to make himself useful again, Locke pulled two lengths of tough cord out of his own cloak and bound Conte's feet and hands with them. He folded a handkerchief three times and used it as a gag. Locke pulled Conte's knives out of their sheaths and passed them to Carlo, who stashed them within his cloak. The Don's study door still hung open, shedding warm light into the passage. The bedchamber doors remained locked tight.
"I pray you both may be gifted with a demand and an endurance well beyond your usual expectations, my lord and lady," whispered Carlo. "Your household thieves would appreciate a short break before continuing with their duties for the evening."
Carlo grasped Conte beneath his arms, and Locke, slouched in obvious pain, nonetheless grabbed the man's feet when Carlo began to drag him all by himself. With tedious stealth, they retraced their steps and deposited the unconscious bodyguard around the far bend in the corridor, just beside the stairs leading back up to the fourth floor laboratories. The Don's study was a most welcome sight when they finally stole in a few minutes later. Locke settled into a deeply cushioned leather armchair on the left-hand wall, while Carlo took up a standing guard position. More laughter could be heard faintly from across the hall.
"We could be here quite a while," said Carlo. "The gods are merciful."
Locke stared at the Don's tall glass-fronted liquor cabinet, one even more impressive than the collection his pleasure barge carried.
"I'd pour us a draught or six, but I don't think it would be in character."
They waited 10 minutes, 15, 20. Locke breathed steadily and deeply, and concentrated on ignoring the throbbing ache that seemed to fill his guts from top to bottom. Yet when the two thieves heard the door across the hallway unbolting, Locke leapt to his feet, standing tall, pretending that his balls didn't feel like clay jugs dropped onto cobblestones from a great height. He cinched his black mask back on and willed a wave of perfect arrogance to claim him from the inside out. As Father Chains had once said, The best disguises were those that were poured out of the heart rather than painted on the face. Carlo kissed the back of his left hand through his own mask and winked. Don Lorenzo Salvara walked into his study whistling, lightly dressed and completely unarmed.
"Close the door," said Locke, and his voice was steady, rich with the absolute presumption of command. "Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
7. An hour past midnight, two men left the Alcigrante district via the Eldrin Arch. They wore black cloaks and had black horses. One of them rode with a leisurely air, while the other led his horse on foot, walking in a curiously bow-legged fashion.
"Unfucking believable," said Carlo. "It really did work out just as you planned. It's a pity we can't brag about this to anyone. Our biggest score ever, and all we had to do was tell our mark exactly what we were doing to him."
"And get kicked around a bit," muttered Locke.
"Yeah, sorry about that. What a beast that man was, eh? Take comfort that he'll feel the same way when he opens his eyes again."
How very comforting. If reassurances could dull pain, nobody would ever go to the trouble of pressing grapes.
"By the crooked warden, I never heard such self-pity dripping from the mouth of a wealthy man. Cheer up! Richer and cleverer than everyone else, right?"
"Richer and cleverer and walking funny, yes." The pair of thieves made their way south through Two Silver Green, toward the first of the stops where they would gradually lose their horses and shed their black clothes, until they were finally heading back to the Temple District dressed as common labourers. They nodded companionably at patrols of yellow jackets, stomping about in the mist with lanterns swaying on pike poles to light their way. Not once were they given any reason to glance up. The fluttering shadow that trailed them on their way through the streets and alleys was quieter than a small child's breath. Swift and graceful, it swooped from rooftop to rooftop in their wake, following their actions with absolute single-mindedness. When they slipped back into the Temple District, it beat its wings and rose into the darkness in a lazy, spiraling circle until it was up above the mists of Camor and lost against the grey haze of the low-hanging clouds.